Okay, this is Bio 160, and it is October 16th. It's Thursday, and we're in the middle of the nervous system. And you have a quiz on the nervous system today from your study guide. So I think we're going to get done with the nervous system today and then look at the study guide on the nervous system. All right, and don't forget, on Blackboard, I put the new study guides, the new handouts that have the unlabeled figures. So you can practice labeling those figures at home, and it's exactly like what you're going to see on the test. Now, you won't get all the figures. You're just going to get a sampling of the figures. Or if there is a figure, you're not going to have to label everything. It's just going to be four or five things on a figure, but you never know which one it is. So print those out and practice labeling them a bunch of times so you get 100% on that part of the test, okay? Okay, now, with regard to the test, we're going to take it on Wednesday, not Monday. Okay. I'm sorry. We're supposed to have it on
Tuesday.
We're supposed to have it Tuesday, the next session, but we're going to finish up senses on Tuesday, so I want to postpone the test one day. So the test is going to be on Thursday. Yeah. Yeah, so a week from today. So it's not on the next class session. It's going to be so the 23rd. Is that right?
23rd.
So it's going to be on the 23rd. So, all right. So, what test is it? It's going to be exam. I think that's your third exam. And it's going to be October 23rd. And it's going to cover chapters 8, 9, and 10. And 10 is senses. We haven't looked at that yet. All right. So nervous system, so muscle, nerve, and senses. All right, now today, don't leave early. Don't leave early today because we got the quiz, but also on your syllabus, you get another take-home quiz. So here is a take-home quiz for the weekend. All right, so when you turn in your weekly quiz, then pick up a take-home, and you got to come to class on Tuesday to turn it in. So you got to be here both today and on Tuesday to get credit for this quiz. All right, so I think that's it. Now, does anybody else have any other questions so far? No? You're good? Okay. Well, we were talking about the central nervous system. Who can tell me what the central nervous system is? Brain and spinal cord. That's right. Everything else is in the peripheral nervous system. And so we were looking at the brain stem, and that's the lowest part of the brain. Okay, let's see if I can get a nice picture of that brain stem someplace. Yeah, here's a nice picture. All right, so this area here is the brain stem. And you can see midbrain, pons, and medulla. We talked about the different functions. All right, the medulla controls a number of autonomic functions in your body, like it controls your heart rate, controls blood flow to various organs by vasoconstricting or vasodilating blood vessels. And it works together with the pons to help regulate respiration. That's breathing in and breathing out. So you don't have to think about it. If you don't want to, of course, you can override that with messages from the higher centers of the brain, your cerebral cortex. You could hold your breath for as long as you wanted until you passed out. Okay? And then once you passed out, well then, the medulla and pons would take over and you'd start breathing again just like normal, except you'd probably hyperventilate for a little while because you held your breath for a long time. Okay. So who's done that? Has anybody done that? You've done that. Anybody else? Anybody have any? Anybody else? Nobody else? I don't think I've done that. At least I can remember. But, yeah, you might have some children that actually do that, okay, if they want to, like, scare you. But should you be scared? No, because as soon as they pass out, they'll start breathing again. Okay. And a break might be nice. Who knows? Okay. All right, so brainstem, what else did we talk about? Diencephalon. Oh, yeah, the diencephalon right here is made up of the thalamus and the hypothalamus. The thalamus is a relay center for signals that are coming up the spinal cord. And in order to reach your conscious perception of reality, those signals have to go to the cerebral cortex. And the only way they can get there is through the thalamus. And the thalamus directs where those signals go in the cerebral cortex. Okay, and as a matter of fact, I think we did get to the cerebrum last time. We were talking about some lobes of the brain. And when we look at the brain, the lobe in the front is the frontal lobe. And the lobe just posterior to it is the parietal. And the lobe posterior to that is the occipital. And there's another one that we don't see on this midline section, but there is a temporal lobe about in this location right here. So you got frontal, parietal, occipital, and temporal lobe. And I think we got another picture in your book that actually shows the temporal lobe. Ah, here we go. All right, so here's just another picture. It's not a section, it's actually kind of an illustration of the whole brain. So here's the frontal, parietal, occipital, and temporal lobe right here. And you should probably know a couple functions of these various lobes. The frontal lobe, in particular, this one that's shaded this nice color right here, which is red, right? This nice red color, right? That's what we call the precentral gyrus, right? Remember that a gyrus is a raised part on the surface of the brain, and then there's a depression. That's what we call a sulcus. And if we put a sulcus and a gyrus together with another sulcus with another gyrus, that's what? Those are folds in the surface of the brain. So this first ridge is for motor control of your body. This is where you initiate any kind of motor activity in your body. And there's this sulcus, we call this the central sulcus, and posterior to the central sulcus is the postcentral gyrus. That's for perception of sensations on the surface of your body. So motor is in the front and sensory is in the back. And how can you remember that? What's maybe another nice kind of analogy for you to remember that the frontal lobe is motor, for instance? Because where do you have the motor in your car?
In the front.
In the front. Okay. Not everybody does, but most people do. Huh? What about a bug? Don't use that. Think about your friend's car then. Okay. And then there's even some really fancy cars that have the motor right smack in the middle. Does anybody have a car like that? No. Oh, well, okay. Well, we're not friends. I'm just your teacher and your students. If you had a motor in the middle of your car, then we could be friends. Okay. Those are really fancy, expensive cars. All right, so don't forget, motor in the front. So here is the motor cortex. Here is the sensory cortex. Motor cortex is part of the frontal lobe. The sensory cortex is in the parietal lobe. And, of course, the occipital lobe is sensory as well. But what sense is that? That's going to be for vision, right? Or you could say for sight. And the temporal lobe, this one right over here, right underneath the temporal bone, that's where your primary auditory cortex is. So that is for hearing. And deep to that is even the olfactory cortex. What's the sense of olfaction? That's smell. Okay, so the smell is deep to the temporal lobe right there. Yeah, I would say so. Okay. All right. So let's see what else we have on this figure. All right, so don't forget, frontal lobe is motor. Here is a motor area for speech. Right, we call this Broca's area. This is the area that we use to pronunciate, to form and pronounce language with our mouth. All right, there's another area, which we call Wernicke's area, which is this one right here. It's not labeled on your diagram, but it's labeled general interpretive area. This one is also important for language, right? But not for motor. What's a component for, if Broca's area is a motor speech area, this area right here is important for understanding speech, right? Not for actually initiating and pronouncing something, but for you listen to what people say, and you hear that with your temporal lobe. You watch their facial expression with your occipital lobe, and the occipital lobe and temporal lobe share that information right here in Wernicke's area, and then you understand, all right, what somebody is saying, right, and maybe implying with their facial expression and the words that they're using, and even the tone of the words that they're using. All right, so that's Wernicke's area. Okay. All right, one of the last areas of the brain is the cerebellum. And we see the cerebellum underneath the occipital lobe and a little bit underneath the parietal lobe. And the cerebellum is important for coordinating muscle movements. So for instance, the frontal lobe initiates them, all right? So you're going to tell your body to do something, but it's the cerebellum that makes sure that you do them appropriately. Like if all of a sudden I want to walk someplace, like walk backwards. All right, so my frontal cortex is beginning to use some muscles in my legs, but as I start to move, I start to lose my balance a little bit, and it's the cerebellum that realizes that there is some air and I might fall down, and the cerebellum then adjusts the muscle tone in my legs and in my back, maintains my balance so that I don't fall down. Okay, so the cerebellum looks at what you want to do, compares it with what you are actually doing, and then makes little corrections so that what you actually do is what you had planned on doing. So that's the job of the cerebellum. All right, so the cerebellum is important for coordinated fine motor movement so that we don't fall on our face, for instance, when we start walking. Okay. So I think that's it for the brain. And we're going to go to the other part of the central nervous system, which is the spinal cord. And the spinal cord begins right where the brain exits the head. And it exits through the occipital bone, and there's a big hole in the occipital bone right about here. I guess the occipital bone is right about here. There's a big hole in it. And that hole is called a foramen magnum, which means big hole. All right, that's where the spinal cord exits. So the spinal cord starts there and goes all the way down, not to the tip of your back or tip of vertebral column, okay, but down to about the second lumbar vertebrae. Let me put this down over here. The second lumbar vertebrae. And let me pull out a slide of the vertebral column. I know I got a nice slide someplace. Right here. Okay. Not labeled, but let's label it. All right, so here's the brain. Here is that nice hole in the occipital bone that we call that foramen magnum. So the spinal cord starts right about here, and it goes down. Where does it look like it ends? Because down over here, do you see these are just nerves? Individual nerves in this region. So the spinal cord actually stops right about here at that level. That's around L2, between L1 and L2. So we have cervical vertebrae in the neck. All right, then we've got thoracic vertebrae, and then lumbar vertebrae about down to here, then the sacral vertebrae, and then the coccygeal down over here. Okay, so that's the extent of the spinal cord. This tip of the spinal cord right here is called the conus medullaris. It just looks like a little cone. That's where it stops. And from this diagram, you can probably guess that a person grows a lot faster as they're growing up compared to their nervous system. And so that's why the spinal cord doesn't grow as tall as somebody actually grows in real life. And there's a little ligament that goes from the conus medullaris all the way down to the sacrum over here. And sometimes the spinal cord actually gets adhered to the sacrum, which is way down over here. And then as somebody is growing, that actually stretches the spinal cord. All right? And that's actually kind of a terrible situation because that damages all the nerves in the spinal cord. We call that a tethered cord. And hopefully we find that very early and reduce that adhesion so that the spinal cord can go back up to L2. And then, that stops creating problems for that person. And all of these nerves down below this region of L2, this is what we call the cauda equina. Does anybody know what caudal means or cauda? Cauda, that means tail, it means toward the tail. All right, so that means tail. And equina means has to do with horses, and so that kind of looks like a horse's tail right there when you look at it, when you have all of these nerves going down past the L2. Okay. So that's pretty much the spinal cord. But let's look at a cross-section of the spinal cord. Next cross-section is... right here. All right, so we're going to look at a nice transverse cut of the spinal cord, and it looks just like this. So we're zoomed in, right? So we now enlarged the spinal cord, and this is the posterior or dorsal, right? This is the dorsal part of it. This is the anterior or ventral part of the spinal cord, and the central area is what we call gray matter. It's probably colored gray on this figure. What do we find inside gray matter? What do we find inside gray matter? It's a location for certain parts of a neuron. Is gray matter myelinated or non-myelinated? Non-myelinated. So don't forget, dendrites and cell bodies don't have myelin on them. So this is where nerve cell bodies and dendrites exist in the spinal cord. This structure that kind of looks like an H. And this structure here kind of looks like a horn, so we call that the posterior horn. And this down over here looks like another horn, that's what we call the anterior horn. And in these areas right here, we have nerve cell bodies and dendrites. All right. Now, signals have to either enter or leave the spinal cord. And there are only two ways that that can happen. And maybe it's a good idea to look at this diagram right here. Okay, so here is a spinal cord. This is dorsal. Here's ventral. Here is one way that signals can either enter or leave the spinal cord, and here's the other way. These are what we call roots. And so this is in the dorsal part of the spinal cord, so we call this the dorsal root. This is the ventral part, so we call this the ventral root. And furthermore, you always have to know that these roots carry information only in one direction. The dorsal root is always going to be sensory, and the ventral root is always going to be motor. So if I was going to draw an arrow up here by the dorsal root, which way are signals going? From the periphery into the central nervous system, or central nervous system into the periphery? You actually see it right here. Okay? So sensory means periphery to the central nervous system. So dorsal root is always sensory information. And the ventral root is always what? Is what we call motor, right? Ventral. And you just have to memorize that. But you know what? If I haven't given this lecture probably in 25 years or so, I could figure it out pretty easy a couple of different ways. And the way that I can remember it real easy is that there is an S in dorsal. And of course, there's an S in sensory. And there's a T in ventral, and there's a T in motor. So that's pretty easy to see. All right. Plus, there's another way, and that is that the architecture of the spinal cord follows the architecture of the brain. So what's in the front part or the anterior part of the brain? Is that sensory or is that motor? You have to think. That's motor, right? So the frontal lobe is motor, right? And that's what? That's the ventral part of the brain. Look at the ventral part of the spinal cord. What is that? That's motor as well, right? And the posterior part of the spinal cord is sensory. What about the parietal lobe and occipital lobe? They are sensory as well, right? So the architecture of the spinal cord matches up with the architecture of the brain, right? So that makes sense. So either way you want to remember those things, that's fine with me. Any questions or anything? So we got the ventral root and the dorsal root of the spinal cord. Furthermore, remember that this is a nice bipolar neuron right here, and here's the cell body. There's always going to be a bump, an enlargement, in the dorsal root, and here is that enlargement on this illustration of this cross-section of the spinal cord right here. This is what we call the dorsal root ganglia. Contains thousands of nerve cell bodies of unipolar neurons, and then this would be the central process coming into the spinal cord. So you got gray matter, And in this area right here, right, this is white matter. What kind of structures of a neuron make up white matter? It's going to be myelinated axons. So these areas right here contain axons. And axons are what? Really long projections of a neuron that are going someplace. And they're myelinated so that they're very fast. And where do signals go in the spinal cord? Do they go up and down, or do they go right and left primarily? You know what? They mostly go up and down. Okay, so the tracts in the spinal cord would be like my pen right here, right? They're moving up and down, and they're myelinated. So all of these areas right here are tracts, myelinated axons that are either going up to the brain, and that would be an afferent tract, or going down to some effector organs, and that would be an efferent tract. And they're all myelinated. Okay, so what's important to know here? Gray matter is located deep in the spinal cord, as opposed to the brain. Gray matter is right on the surface. But, of course, in the spinal cord, it's what? It's deep. And it consists of nerve cell bodies and dendrites that synapse with other nerve fibers from the periphery or maybe even from the brain. The white matter is located superficially. That means what? In the periphery of the spinal cord. And it consists of tracts that transmit electrical impulses either up to the brain or down to the body. And then we have nerves that either enter or leave the spinal cord. Right, sensory carry information to the spinal cord. Another name for that would be afferent. And you have motor nerves that carry impulses away from the spinal cord. We call that efferent. And don't forget, there are two ways that signals can either enter or leave the spinal cord. And those are what we call the roots, the dorsal root versus the ventral. And dorsal is 100% sensory. 100% sensory. The ventral root is motor. What percentage? 100%. That's right. So, for instance, when somebody has maybe a motor deficit, maybe they can't move their right leg, for instance. Okay, if somebody can't move their right leg due to compression of a nerve, maybe they have intervertebral disc that is impinging upon a nerve. They have normal sensation in their leg, but they just can't move it. Right? Where is that lesion going to be? Is it going to be on the dorsal root, or is it going to be on the ventral root? It's going to be on the ventral root. So part of that intervertebral disc has slipped out between the vertebrae and is compressing this root right here. Now what happens if they have both a sensory as well as a motor deficit? Where did that intervertebral disc end up? It's compressing both the ventral root and the dorsal root. And if it's purely sensory, which can happen, maybe somebody just has pain or kind of a funny sensation, which we call paresthesia, then it is just what? It's just the dorsal root right here without any kind of motor deficit. All right, remember when we were talking about dorsiflexion? And I said sometimes a physician will look at the tips of your shoes to see if you're dragging your toes over the ground, right? And that's kind of dangerous if you're an elderly person because you'll trip and fall and break something really bad. All right, and what did I say that was a nice indication of? Okay, that was an indication of a spinal cord lesion, right? Spinal cord lesion. And now you know exactly which root it would be. Which root would it be? The ventral root, where somebody doesn't have the right motor coordination to lift their toes up off the ground. We call that what? Dorsiflexion. So if you can't dorsiflex, it could be due to a lesion right here in the ventral root, in that part of the spinal cord that controls your foot right here. Okay. All right, so that's spinal cord. Let's see what we have next. Reflexes. Okay, let's take a look at some reflexes. Reflexes are something that your body can do, and it protects some part of your body, and they happen very fast, and they happen without your conscious thought. So they happen automatically. And You need a central nervous system in order for a reflex to take place, but you don't need a brain. So if you don't need your brain, but you need central nervous system for a reflex to take place, where is it taking place? What part of? The only other place would be the spinal cord. So reflexes always involve the spinal cord at some layer, some level. Okay. So these are the parts of a reflex or a reflex arc. A reflex arc always starts with a stimulus. And you know what? I don't know if I have that on your sheet, so make sure you write that down. Stimulus. A reflex arc always starts with a stimulus. If a reflex starts without a stimulus, okay, that would be like a hallucination or something, right? That would be something that isn't real, right? So a reflex arc always starts with the stimulus. And in order for your body to appreciate a stimulus, like for instance, light could be a stimulus. What do you need functioning in your person, in your body, so that light can act as a stimulus for it? You need photoreceptors, like we find in eyeballs, right? If you don't have photoreceptors in your eyes, can you respond to light? No, you can't, right? And as a matter of fact, if somebody jabs you with a pencil or something, you have to have pain receptors. And if you don't have functioning pain receptors, you won't feel that. Or sound. What do you need in order to appreciate sound? You need receptors in your ears that function, that can actually perceive vibrations that are in the air. Right? So the second part of a reflex arc is a receptor. You have to have a receptor for that particular modality of energy. And that receptor then sends a signal via a neuron to the brain. We call that a sensory neuron. What's another name for a sensory neuron? Starts with an A. Afferent, an afferent neuron. All right, and that goes, how do signals get into the brain? Which root of the spinal cord? The, remember there's an S in sensory. There's also a S in dorsal. Goes in the dorsal root. Okay, so passes the dorsal root ganglia. Where do we see that? All right, so here is sensory nerve that's going past the dorsal root ganglia in the dorsal root. Now it's entered the central nervous system. All right, and it's going to synapse on an association neuron. This association neuron right here is going to analyze that information, figure out if it's a harmful stimulus or if it's a stimulus that can be ignored. Like I can put my hand on the projector here and I go, oh, that's hot. But what did my association neuron decide? Well, way before I realized that it was hot but not damaging. That association neuron in my spinal cord automatically realized, well, that's not hot enough to cause tissue damage, so it didn't initiate some kind of reflex, right? But if it was really hot, my hand would have just jumped away from it before I even knew I was touching something hot. All right, so this association neuron analyzes the information, makes a decision on what to do, and if it is a damaging stimulus, then the association neuron is going to send a signal out the ventral root into a motor neuron, which is going to go to an effector organ. In this particular case, it's going to be a muscle, and it's going to cause that muscle to contract, which will produce a response. The response would be to move my body away from the stimulus which is causing tissue damage. So this is a whole reflex arc. So typical kinds of questions that I would ask is, how does a reflex arc always start? With a stimulus. And how does a reflex arc always end? With a response, right? So you just have to fill in some of the pieces. Okay, so let me see. I got a reflex arc right here that's missing one little piece to it. Let me see if I got another one. Yeah, I do. So let's look at this reflex arc on this diagram. You know, this might even be an exam figure. Maybe. Okay. It is in one of my classes. I can't remember if it's this one or not. Yeah, it's that one right there. Yeah, let's go over this one. Let's go over this one really good. Okay, so we see this arrow right here on this neuron. Which way is this arrow pointing? To the central nervous system or to the periphery? To the CNS. So is this a motor or a sensory neuron? It's got to be sensory. Don't forget, another name for sensory is afferent. All right, so before this nerve fiber can carry a signal to the brain, what has to start a reflex arc? A stimulus, right? So I wrote that in because it's not on your figure right here, but you got a tack. So you step on that tack, that is a stimulus, and of course that tack is going to produce tissue damage, right? It's going to damage, so that's an adequate stimulus for this neuron right here. So you have a pain receptor. All right, so let's start at the beginning. Stimulus, number one, stimulates a receptor, number two, and the receptor sends a signal up the afferent neuron. That's the third part of a reflex. And then that goes all the way to the spinal cord. And how does sensory information enter the spinal cord? Which root? The dorsal root. That's the only way to get in there. So it passes the dorsal root ganglia. That's where all the cell bodies for the sensory neuron exist, in the dorsal root. It enters the spinal cord, and you can see it ending right here at that little Y-shaped structure at the end of this axon. And it's going to send a signal to this neuron that's completely found only in the gray matter of the spinal cord. That's what we call an association neuron, or sometimes we call that an interneuron. So this neuron right here is going to analyze that information, and it's going to determine if it's really harmful. What would you guess, stepping on a tack? Harmful, right? Tissue damage. So this association neuron then immediately is going to send a signal to a motor neuron that goes to your thigh. So here is the next part of the reflex arc, the efferent neuron. Sends a signal to this muscle. That muscle is an effector. It gets stimulated into contracting, and when it contracts, it withdraws your foot away from that tack. So removing your body away from that harmful stimulus is what we call the response. And the response is just the end of that reflex arc. Okay, so that's a nice reflex arc. It's got all the components. So we see three neurons in this particular reflex arc. We got, which ones are they? We got the, let's talk about it in the correct order in which they work for us. The first one is the sensory. The second one is the association, and the third one is the motor neuron right here. Okay, there's only one of those three that's only found in the central nervous system. That's the only place you find it. Which one is completely surrounded by central nervous system? You don't find it in the periphery at all. It is that interneuron. See that interneuron right there? It's only in the central nervous system. But the afferent neuron, what, spends some of its time in the peripheral nervous system and can also be found in the central nervous system. The motor neuron, the cell body is in the central nervous system, but the axon is in the peripheral nervous system. So you can find it in both places. The sensory and motor neurons are found partly in the peripheral nervous system and partly in the central nervous system, but this association neuron or the interneuron is only found 100% within the central nervous system. Okay, so that's a reflex arc. And so this is the spinal cord down over here. Do you have any awareness of what's happening in your spinal cord? Does that reach your conscious thought at all? You know what? It doesn't. The only place that works to provide you with any kind of conscious appreciation of what's going on around you is in the gray matter of the cerebral cortex right here. So all of this processing of information in the spinal cord is without your appreciation, but nonetheless, it happens very fast, and it does what? It protects your body from harmful stimulus. Okay. So that's the beauty of a reflex. It happens, it protects your body before you even know that your body is being damaged. Okay. All right, let's look at another thing that's real important. The meninges of the brain. The meninges are membranes that surround the brain. And inside your brain, for instance, if we look inside the brain, let's see, where do we have a picture inside the brain? Here's an inside picture of the brain. All right, so here's an inside picture. Here's spinal cord, right? Brainstem, the cerebellum here, and the cerebral cortex. Now, do you have any bones in your brain? Bones are important because they can support your body, right? And they can protect various structures. But inside your brain, you have no bones for support or for protection, right? And the brain tissue is actually fairly delicate and fairly soft. And so the way that our bodies protect our brain is to surround it with some very important and protective membranes on the outside. Okay, it surrounds the brain on the outside. And those protective membranes are what we call the meninges. And it's so important that there are actually three of them. There are three meninges. And we're going to look and see where these are. From superficial to deep, the meninges are the dura mater, the arachnoid, and the pia mater. So when I say superficial to deep, where's the superficial one? That's out by the surface, right? And the deep one is the inner one. Right, exactly right. Okay, dura mater, what does dura mean? Durable means it's really tough. It's very, very tough. The pia mater is the weakest of the membranes. It's the thinnest one. Okay, so let's take a look. Let's see what these look like. All right, so here we have a nice kind of cross-section, a coronal section on somebody's head. We're looking from the back. All right, so here is the brain. We can see the cerebellum right here in the spinal cord. But let's zoom in to this region right on the superior surface of the brain, right on midline. So let's just zoom into this region here. All right, so now we've zoomed into this region. And let's get oriented. Well, we got some bones right here. For instance, these are probably like the parietal bones that form the part of the cranium right here. And underneath the skull bones, we have the brain. So here is brain, and here is brain. Right on the most superficial surface of the brain, that's what we call cortical gray matter. Does it look gray to you? All right, and then deep is going to be white matter. These are tracts taking information that's being developed by the surface of the cortical gray matter. All right, so this is your brain right here. All right, and then we have the membranes. Here is a membrane that's sitting right on top of the surface of the brain. This is the thinnest membrane. This is what we call the pia mater. And every little fold of the brain, every little sulcus and every gyrus, right, the pia follows it exactly. It covers the exact surface of the brain and is just glued right onto it. So that's the pia mater. Right, and then if we go to the other end, right, if we look at the cranial bones, just deep to the cranial bones, for instance, like right in this region right here, that's the dura mater. Right, that's the toughest membrane. That's the most superficial. Okay, and you can see that the dura mater even goes down into the longitudinal fissure that separates the cerebral hemispheres. Okay, so that the cerebral hemispheres really aren't connected to each other on either side of that longitudinal fissure. So this light area right here is the dura mater, and the dura mater is very leathery. It's very difficult to cut. It's very difficult to disturb. The pia mater, oh, you could cut very easily with a spoon or a butter knife. It's not very tough at all. But the dura mater, oh, with a knife, you probably couldn't even cut it. You would need a really sharp knife or a scalpel or a razor blade or something because it's so tough. So guess what kind of chemical compound is in the dura mater? A lot of collagen. A lot of collagen, right? Not very much collagen in the pia mater. Okay, so we talked about the most superficial one right here. And there's one in between the dura mater and the pia mater, and that is this one right here that kind of looks gray to me a little bit, right there. I don't know, what color does this look like right at the tip of my marker right there? Blue? Purple? Pink? Okay. I'm glad I'm not the only one that's colorblind. Okay, well, whatever color that is, right in here, right, that's the arachnoid. So we've got the dura mater right here, the arachnoid right here, and the pia mater right there, right where those dots are. Can you see that okay on the screen? Okay. But notice that there's this big space between the arachnoid and the pia mater. And we've got some fibers in there that are holding the arachnoid to the pia mater, but in this space right here, it's mostly filled with fluid. And that fluid is what we call cerebrospinal fluid, or CSF. So do you see cerebrospinal fluid right here? All right, that's what fills this space that's deep to the arachnoid. And because it's deep to the arachnoid, we call that the subarachnoid space. So that might help you piece together this diagram, because you know what? This diagram is probably an exam figure too. It's so important to know something about the meninges and the cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, so that's what you have to know about this particular fluid, or the meninges, dura mater, arachnoid, pia mater, and underneath the arachnoid is a space that's filled with fluid. And that fluid helps absorb shock, trauma to the head, right? So that the bones, these bones right here, if you bonk this bone right here, that trauma doesn't get transmitted directly to the brain. It gets transmitted to this fluid, and that fluid can squish around, and it protects the brain as it's being squished around a little bit. Okay, so that's the meninges. The pia mater, what it's composed of? I just wanted you to get a sense that the dura mater is the thickest and the toughest one, and that the other membranes are not nearly as tough. The arachnoid is fairly tough, and the pia is not very tough at all. Okay, but the one that really does most of the work is the dura mater, the durable layer, right, the dura mater. They all have collagen to some extent because that's the molecule that is used in your body to give different tissues strength, but it's the dura mater that contains most of the collagen, and it's the thickest layer as well. I might want to come back to that figure in a little bit. Okay. Okay, let's look at peripheral nervous system. And nerves will leave the central nervous system and go into your periphery. And you have nerves that leave your brain. And you also have nerves that leave your spinal cord. So you have two kinds of nerves from where they leave your central nervous system. You also have nerves that bring information into the CNS. You're familiar with this already. Those are sensory. You have nerves that take information away, right? So the two divisions are sensory, which is afferent, motor, or what we call efferent. And then functionally also, the nerves can have two general different kinds of functions. Some nerves carry information to things that you have control over in your body. Those are what we call voluntary nerves. What kinds of parts that in your body do you have voluntary control over? Skeletal muscle. As a matter of fact, that's the only thing. Right? So, and we call that somatic. Somatic motor would be to skeletal muscle. I guess I'll label that in right here. That's pretty important. Skeletal muscle. All right, other nerves are what we call autonomic. They don't go to skeletal muscle. They go to places of your body that are controlled automatically. What places in your body are controlled automatically? Everything else besides skeletal, which includes heart. So I would say, instead of heart, I'm going to say cardiac, muscle, smooth muscle. Where do you have smooth muscle? Like in blood vessels, digestive tract, reproductive tract, respiratory tract. Okay, have smooth muscle. You can't control your digestive tract. Okay, urinary tract. And then the third thing would be glands. So nerves go to glands. Autonomic nerves go to glands because you can't control secretion of glands either in your body. Okay. All right, so nerves can either enter or leave the central nervous system either from the brain or the spinal cord. And if they leave from the brain, we call those cranial nerves. And if they leave from the spinal cord, we call those spinal nerves. You have 12 pairs of cranial nerves and 31 pairs of spinal nerves. So let me see what I can find here to show you. Okay. So cranial nerves, where do cranial nerves arise from? From the brain. So here is a picture of the brain. This is the ventral surface, so we're looking from underneath the brain, looking up toward the base of the brain. Here we have the spinal cord, and the brain is colored in gray, and the cranial nerves are shown in yellow right here. All right, so how many, I might ask you how many cranial nerves there are. How many are there? There's 12. That's going to be really important to know all of these nerves when you take another class, maybe like an anatomy class or physiology. Maybe not so important in this one, but you should at least know that there are 12. And so they're given a name and a number. And the numbering system is very easy to understand. From anterior to posterior, they're labeled from 1 to 12. Right? So even if you don't know or haven't memorized it, you can just count. Right? So the most anterior is number 1. Right? The next one is number 2. And then the next one is number 3 and 4 and 5 on down the line. So it's not very difficult to tell the number, right? But the names, you have to study a little bit to understand the names, but I can maybe tell you a little trick that might help you in another class. Okay. Number 1 is the olfactory nerve. All right, so let's just talk about that one for a second. What is the sense of olfaction?
Smell.
And what's the most anterior organ on your face? That's your nose, right? So it makes sense that the first cranial nerve is for olfaction or for the sense of smell because it sends nerves right down into your nasal cavity for you to smell. What's another anterior organ on your face? Your eyes, for vision, right? So number 2 is the optic nerve, all right? So the olfactory nerve is purely sensory. It brings the sense of smell to your brain. Cranial nerve number 2, or the optic nerve, is purely sensory, brings visual information to your brain. All right, number 3, oculomotor. That helps move your eyeballs around, okay, so that you can look in different places without turning your head. Okay, trochlear, trigeminal. So I might ask you something about cranial nerves 1, 2, and 3. Those are pretty easy to understand. And then the other one that's real important, this is not an exam figure, as far as I know, okay, is cranial nerve number 10 down over here. And you could count down to number 10. Cranial nerve number 10 is what we call the vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve is very important because it's part of the parasympathetic nervous system. Can you tell me what the counterpart to the parasympathetic nervous system is? You might have to go all the way back to the first page of your notes. All right, there's another division that's antagonistic to the parasympathetic, and that's the sympathetic nervous system, right? The vagus, or cranial nerve number 10, is purely parasympathetic. And the effect on the heart is that it slows the heart rate down, so it decreases HR. Vagus nerve decreases the heart rate. So that's probably something that you should know as well. Say that again. Something's not working? Okay, sorry. Vagus nerve, number 10. So you should know the name, the number, and what the effect is on the heart. That's going to be really important. Okay. So if someone is interested in knowing how you can match up the names of the cranial nerves with their number, what I like to do is use a mnemonic. Anybody know what a mnemonic is? M-N-E-O-N-I-C, mnemonic. All right, and a mnemonic is a saying or a poem or something that you can remember relatively easily, and the first letter of the word in the mnemonic corresponds to the first letter of a list of words that you can't possibly memorize without spending a lot of time on it. Okay? So we're going to come up with a sentence or a poem or something that has words that begin with an O, and an O, and an O, and then a T, right? And then another T and an A down the line. And this is the mnemonic that I like to use for the cranial nerves. Let's see if I can remember what it is. All right, it goes something like this. Should I use a different colored pen? Maybe. Let's see. All right, so I like to use Oh, that's a nice one. On Olympus. I have to spell it right. Towering. Top. What's Olympus right here? That's a mountain. That's a huge mountain in Europe, right? On Olympus's towering top, because Olympus is a really huge, tall mountain, and then on the top, right? A Finn. What's a Finn? Somebody that was born in Finland, right? Huh? I forgot an O. Thank you. On old, because it's a very old mountain. On old Olympus's towering top, a Finn, and who should he be messing around with? Another friend. German. All right. Viewed. Viewed. Looked at. V. A. Hop. What's a hop? Nobody knows what a hop is in here probably, but I'll be happy to tell you. A hop is, it's something that is put in, it's a grain that's used to make beer. Right, because Germans and Finns, I guess, really love beer or something, and they just like to see fields growing with things that will eventually be turned into beer. All right, so this is what? Olfactory, optic, oculomotor. What's the next one? Trochlear, trigeminal. What's this one? Abducens. All right, so abducens. What is to abduct? Abduction versus adduction. So abduction is to move away from midline. Adduction is to move toward midline. So the abducens is a nerve that works on your eye that moves your eye away from midline. Abducens. Right? So it makes it calls for a lateral rotation of the eye. Not both of them at the same time, but one or the other. And then you have number 7, facial, that's fin, and is vestibulocochlear. Does that make sense? Oh, you have a frown on your face saying it doesn't make sense. So we have A for vestibulocochlear. But the reason why that is because the vestibular cochlear is the nerve that goes to your ears. So it used to be called, until we simplified it and called it vestibulocochlear, it used to be called the auditory nerve. Okay, so that's where A comes from, auditory nerve, which today simplified is what? Vestibulocochlear. When we get into the next chapter, huh?
That's simplified?
Yeah, that's simplified. You'll see why in the next chapter. Okay, vestibulocochlear. And G, what's G? Glossopharyngeal. Viewed is? Viewed. What's that? Vagus. So that's number 10, right? Big X right here. Accessory and hypoglossal. All right. So, so sometimes an instructor just might ask you, well, what cranial nerve is the hypoglossal nerve? Excuse me, the hypoglossal nerve. And you're just going to say, oh, well, that's easy. Because in this saying right here, there's only one H, there's only one hop, well, it's got to be number 12, okay? So if you look at that a couple times, it will make some kind of sense. But in this class, what I really want you to know is cranial nerves number 1, 2, and 3, all right? Number 1 is for smell, number 2 is for vision, number 3 is for controlling your eyes, motor for eyes. Vestibulocochlear, that's kind of interesting because that's the auditory nerve. Oh, and the vagus, don't forget vagus. What number is the vagus? Is number 10. So that is easy to know. It's used for other things too. But for what you have to know in here, it slows the heart rate down.
So if somebody doesn't, that means it's not working?
So if the heart can't slow down, then there's a problem with the parasympathetic signal going to the heart. And it could be due to the vagus, or it could be due to some other problem somewhere between the brain and the heart. Okay? So somebody would want to know why that is. Most people don't have a problem with the vagus. They have a problem more with speeding the heart up. The body has a tendency to slow the heart down pretty easily. Okay? And if somebody's heart is too slow, that's when they have a pacemaker. Okay? That makes it go. But yours is going too fast? Yeah, so that might be something involved with the vagus right here. Right? Okay. All right, so that's one part. I lost track of my slide. Is that it? Good. Okay, now these cranial nerves that I was showing you right here, sometimes these cranial nerves like the olfactory and optic are 100% sensory. They never send signals out to your eye or to your nose, right? They're purely sensory. And the oculomotor, on the other hand, is never sensory. It always is sending signals out to move your eyes around. So it's not like those spinal nerves that are always mixed. So let's take a look at a spinal nerve. All right, the spinal nerves right here, we said you have 31 pairs of them. And what do they look like? Okay. Here are spinal nerves. So here's a spinal nerve leaving the spinal cord. And we never name them. We always just give them a division of the vertebral column that they originate from, like cervical or thoracic, and then what level. And don't forget, you've got 12 thoracic vertebrae, so you have spinal nerves 1 through 12. And you have 7 cervical vertebrae, so you have spinal nerves C1 through C8, because you actually have one spinal nerve that leads between the occipital bone and C1 over here. So that's why you have one additional spinal nerve. And if you count those all up, you've got 31 of them. All right, so you don't have to know the names of any of these nerves or anything like that. Okay. But you should just know cranial nerves come from the brain, spinal nerves come from the spinal cord. Okay. Yeah. All right, so what's page number 9 look like? Rats. Page number 9. Cranial nerve function. That's too much. Autonomic nervous system. Yeah, what do I want you to know about the autonomic nervous system? Okay. Let me see. Oh, yeah, a couple divisions of the autonomic nervous system. Well, you know the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system. You've got parasympathetic and sympathetic. Okay, parasympathetic stimulation leaves your central nervous system from a cranial nerve, mostly number 10, and from some sacral nerves way down over here on your sacrum. So we say parasympathetic outflow is craniosacral. And there is no place in the middle from the spinal cord right here that parasympathetic stimulation can stimulate any organs whatsoever. It's either from cranial nerves or these sacral nerves. Sympathetic stimulation, on the other hand, never comes from the central nervous system via cranial nerves or sacral nerves. It's from these middle divisions of your spinal cord. Okay, so here we can see that it is from T1 through L2. So we call this thoracolumbar outflow. Let's look at heart rate for a second. So here is outflow from cranial nerve number 10. That's a cranial nerve. That's the vagus nerve. And eventually it's going to find its way to the heart. What's the effect on the heart? It slows it down. All right? Sympathetic stimulation right? In order to have nice, precise control over your heart, right? Here is how sympathetic stimulation reaches your heart. It's got to go all the way down to the thoracic region, leave the spinal cord, and then find its way to the heart. So sympathetic stimulation is going to stimulate the heart, increase heart rate. So in terms of the two divisions, the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, they're always going to have opposite effects on various parts of your body. All right, so for instance, so you have parasympathetic and sympathetic stimulation going to the digestive tract. The parasympathetic nervous system is going to increase digestion. All right, so parasympathetic increases digestion. What's going to be the effect of sympathetic stimulation? It's going to decrease digestion. All right, so you don't really know necessarily which way things go. You just always know that they're going to be opposite each other. Okay, the same thing for pupil constriction versus pupil dilation. One is going to cause your pupils to constrict and the other is going to cause your pupils to dilate. Okay. And I think that's probably that's the most important thing about the autonomic nervous system for you to know. Except a couple of the following things. And then we'll take the quiz. The parasympathetic nervous system, which is this one right here, is the one that we call the rest and digest nervous system. Or sometimes we call it rest and repose. So this is the part of the nervous system that is operating when you're in kind of a quiet mood, when you're just contemplating and maybe watching a TV show that's not very interesting, like maybe a presidential debate or something, right? Okay, you're just kind of relaxed and everything is in control, right? That's the parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system, on the other hand, okay, we see that it is responsible for increasing heart rate. This is what we call the flight or fight nervous system. So this is the nervous system that becomes stimulated when you're presented with some very anxious moments or scary moments. All right, and let's just kind of use an example. For instance, you were driving down the freeway to get to school today, and all of a sudden somebody cut you off on the freeway and there was this big semi-tractor trailer just was changing lanes at the same time, and it looked like you had no place to go and you're going to get run over. Okay, for sure you thought you were going to die. All right, so what happened to your heart rate? It just went way up. And what about your pupils? Oh, your eyes got really big, right? Because you're looking at the situation. Blood flow to your muscles increased dramatically. Your heart rate went way up because your body was preparing for a very strenuous situation, right? And preparing you to get out of the way of that truck. So we call that the flight or fight response. But for instance, when you're just in a relaxed state, you don't need a lot of blood going to muscles. You don't need your respiratory rate to be elevated. You don't need your heart rate to be elevated. Right, that's going to be dominated by the parasympathetic nervous system.
Fight or flight.
Because when you're presented with a dangerous situation, okay, your body has to make up its mind whether it's going to run away. And if you run away, you want to run really, really fast to get out of the way. Or you might confront the situation and fight. That's a sympathetic nervous system. Okay. So if you're going to go see a movie, for instance, and you're going to pay $15 to go see a movie, what part of the nervous system does that movie key into and stimulate? Is it going to stimulate the sympathetic nervous system or the parasympathetic nervous system? Okay. Well, for instance, if you're going to see a movie, if it stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system, it's going to make you fall asleep. Okay? But if it's going to cause your heart rate to increase, your respiratory rate to increase, your pupils to dilate, get really big, that's the sympathetic nervous system. So most people pay to see movies that stimulate their sympathetic nervous system, mostly. They're antagonistic. The parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems are antagonistic to each other. Okay, so we got a bunch of study questions right here. But you know what? The answers to these study questions are all in the notes. Like it says right here, number 22, the last one. Which division is responsible for the flight or fight response? That's the sympathetic nervous system. So you guys have a good shot at answering all these questions. If you're stumped, you got to see me during office hours, either Monday or Tuesday before the test. Oh, the test is Thursday. We can go over these on Tuesday. Thank you. Okay. Very good. As a matter of fact, start working on those questions over the weekend so we can go over them really well.